Welcome to the Cloud Pod, where the forecast is always cloudy. We talk weekly about all things AWS, GCP, and Azure. We are your hosts,
Justin,
Jonathan,
Ryan,
and Peter.
Episode 160, recorded on April 6th, 2022. The Cloud Pod goes fishing on Google Big Lake. Good evening, Jonathan and Peter. How are you doing?
Good. Been a long week.
Doing well.
It has been a long week once again, but that doesn't mean that nothing is happening in the cloud. It's busy in that world as well. So we can definitely get into some stories tonight. And first up, I have an article here from VentureBeat for you guys. It piqued my interest a little bit because it's titled How to Choose the Right AWS Region for Your Business. And I don't know for you guys, but VentureBeat is not the people I would be asking for this input, but we're going to go with it anyways. So they started out this article with a scenario where an e-commerce company is apparently approaching the holidays and it is out of capacity. Issue could potentially kill their business. And to address this, they requested an additional 4,000 instances to support peaks in North California region, which tells me clearly that the e-commerce company has hired the wrong cloud engineers, because if you need to scale, North California is not the location you should have gone to.
Not the place.
So they said, these 4,000 instances were in a new AZ. And so, of course, the next answer is, well, you could do a different AZ in the same region, potentially get your capacity or split it across, but then you get killed by AZ data transfer costs and all kinds of other things. And then they go on to say, but if you move that workload to Oregon, you could save money and be able to scale because Oregon's so much bigger, which is true. But they then break down your three decisions to consider in your region choice. And their choices are latency and performance of the region, capacity management of the region. Is it one of the primary regions in the case of North California versus Oregon? And the cost of that particular region. And these are the three things that they said. And I don't know, I thought you guys might have more things to think about when you're considering a region decision.
Data sovereignty.
That was the first one that came.
Data sovereignty, man. That's the number one reason.
Yeah, data sovereignty was.
And whether services are actually available in that region, because the rollout's fairly slow. Starting in US East 1 and eventually makes their way out to Ohio and other places.
Yeah.
Yeah, service availability, data sovereignty. All right, we move theirs down to options 3, 4, and 5 from 1, 2, and 3.
Yes.
Just like that.
I think there's also, other considerations as well around, future growth plans, your strategic opportunities. Like, just because you're based in California, for example, maybe you want to create a SaaS company that's going to market to companies in Boston or in New York. Maybe you want to be based in Virginia instead. Which is sort of that latency performance, but the way they classify their latency performance is your latency and performance, which is different than what your business or service needs. So there's definitely a lot of factors into these things. Obviously don't, if you want to scale massively, I would not choose North California as your choice.
I mean, I'd also say that picking a region is not the right choice either. I mean, you want to pick multiple regions. Why not?
Yeah, if you're an e-commerce site that's going to be dead in the water if your site goes down, due to capacity issues in Black Friday, you should definitely be multi-regional and globally load balancing.
And luckily, all the regions are far enough apart to where you don't have to worry about how far apart the regions are to pick your DR region.
In the US at least, yeah.
Oh, good point. Yeah, I haven't done the math on the two regions in Tasmania yet.
Is it like Melbourne and Sydney? Not that far apart, really. Perhaps a
no. They're far. They're plenty far apart.
That's Pacific tsunami.
10-hour drive. That's a 10-hour. Well, good point. I mean, Pacific tsunami. But I mean, they're definitely meet the mileage requirement.
Yeah.
But probably.
I mean, if there was a Pacific tsunami of that size, that would take out the the eastern coast of Australia. I don't know. There's anybody left who cares about DR at that point.
Yeah. Nobody left to buy the products anyway.
Yeah.
I think Japan is the other one that I always wonder about from availability zone, because it's an island, but it's a big island, so perhaps it's not a big of a deal. But those are two I always think about when I think about regions that are close together.
As long as they're 50 miles apart, usually you're contractually good with all your customers who forced you to have DR, and then you have force majeure clauses, so you're off the hook if they both go down.
All right, well, Amazon this week is announcing support for EKS 1.22 support for Kubernetes. However, they did intend to ship with the etcd 352 release, which is the recommended option for Kubernetes 1.22. But Amazon's crack engineers found there is an issue that potentially caused inconsistency issues. And so they worked with the EKS, the etcd team, and are working with them to resolve the issues. And so, you know, you can't say that Amazon doesn't contribute to open source. There are lots of changes to Kubernetes 1.22, a lot of deprecations of APIs. So do read the documentation if you are making the move, and do apply these to your test environment before going to production. There are new ingress changes as well, including the retirement of the V1 beta API versions for ingress. If you're using the AWS Load Balancer Controller 2.4 we talked about 4 or 5 weeks ago here on the show, you're in good shape already. There's new webhook resource API endpoints, and there's custom resource definitions are now officially stable, or CRDs as we call them for short. And there's a new server-side apply, which is a new object merge algorithm and tracking of field ownership running on the Kubernetes API server. And this means it helps users and controllers manage the resources declaratively, and it's a nice replacement for kubectl apply. AWS also wants you to know that Kubernetes release cadence is slowing down this year with only 3 releases instead of the number of 4. And so as they they implement beta features, they will take a full 12 months to come to a stable market versus the previous 9 months. And all I can think is maybe AWS bribed the Kubernetes governance board because they were tired of trying to keep up with Kubernetes and the quarterly patch releases that they were doing.
Was that? Urgently needed features of a relatively young product are all implemented. I think everyone will be happier with a slower release cycle.
I took that it was AWS that were only going to do 3 releases this year, but it sounds like it's actually Kubernetes itself, which is only 3 releases this year. Huh. Interesting.
Very interesting. Amazon EC2 now provides a new and improved launch experience on the EC2 console. The Amazon EC2 console introduces the new and improved launch experience, a quicker and easier way to launch an instance. The new design provides a single page layout, allowing you to view all of your settings in one location, and you no longer need to navigate back and forth between steps to ensure your configuration is correct. The new inline AMI selector provides a simpler selection of OS and versioning, and also has you display your recently used AMI so that you can quickly select frequently used AMIs. You can now also compare instance types, allowing you to search, sort, and filter by various instance type attributes, making it easier to decide which instance type to use, meaning they're coming right after you, ec2instances.info, because that's the number one reason why I use that site is when I'm in the instance picker trying to figure out which one I actually want. Well, typically I'm writing the code in Terraform, but when I'm in the console, I also have to look it up. Have either of you tried the new console experience?
The anti-wizard? I call it the anti-wizard.
Right.
I have not.
I've written code to spin up my instances.
Yeah, I haven't launched anything from the last time I launched anything using the wizard was, on an outage call or something, and we desperately need a server to log into really quickly in a particular subnet or something. But in general, don't use the console for deploying things at all anymore. But having said that, I can see if you are a console user, it must be so much nicer now to not have to click through those 5 separate pages of configurations.
So much easier to scroll up and down on a page.
Yeah.
Well, and it was particularly annoying when you would pick an instance, or you go to the very last page that has the review section and you're like, oh no, I had to go back. Which page is that on? And you fix something. But yeah, I'm just looking at it right now. I just logged into an account and, it's definitely the picker is much nicer. I do like this. The recent item on that. You can pick a nice Amazon Linux instance pretty quickly. My architecture, my instance type, the little compare button here is pretty snazzy. It's a nice chart layout. It doesn't have pricing though, which would be what I would desperately want in this screen. you can't get everything you want all the time, I guess. And then your key pair selection, your networking setup. Again, I do see, a couple of defaults here that I'm not super jazzed about. Like allow HTTPS traffic from the internet is just a checkbox. Maybe you don't want to do that. Allow SSH traffic from anywhere is the default here, so maybe that's not so great either. But you can change your security groups, and then you pull those in. And then your configure storage. And then there's a whole advanced thing, which is where you can specify spot and your shutdown behaviors and placement groups and licensing and user data. I wish user data was actually in the main part of the wizard, because that's probably something you would do where the rest of this is stuff that you typically don't have to monkey with. But yeah, not too bad. Considering they've redesigned this interface about 5 times and only made it worse, this is a nice positive direction, I think.
That's good. I like it. I like the positive spin there. It's awesome.
I mean, when you make it bad over and over and over again, eventually your users will yell at you enough that you'll listen to them. So, much like this next announcement, which is that AWS organizations now provide central AWS account closure to enable easier end-to-end account lifecycle management. And you now centrally close member accounts in your AWS organization through the console and programmatically via the AWS command line interface and the SDK. This feature makes it easier and more efficient to manage your AWS workloads. So when you're using, you know, the built-in AWS account provisioner and you accidentally screw that up and provision 1,000 accounts, you now no longer can close without going to each one of them and logging into it. This is a very handy feature.
Yeah, where's the applause track? I think people have been waiting this for years.
Years. I'm still going into accounts. Because we do a lot of like sandbox accounts and stuff that is clearly meant to be temporary. And it's such a pain in the butt not having this.
Yeah, I kind of wish there was a deliberate sandbox account type, actually, where you spin it up and you say, the lifetime of this account's only going to be 3 days. Shut it down automatically after 3 days or X many days, as the case may be.
Yeah.
That'd be really nice.
Now all they got to do is allow us to get them out of the suspended mode in the org's screen quicker, because I'm still looking at ones that I don't want to see anymore.
You can now get a feature that I always thought was ridiculous. So when you had an EC2 instance running in the console that had a hardware failure underneath it, you would get this lovely email in your mailbox saying that, I'm sorry to tell you that something horrible happened to the host running your instance. And here you can click this link that'll link you to the console and you can press the start button to restart your instance. And I always thought to myself, you could have started it for me in the time it took you to send this email. And so now officially it's official. Amazon EC2 now automatically recovers by default, making it easier for customers to recover instances when they become unreachable. And the automatic recovery improves instance availability by recovering the instance if it becomes impaired due to an underlying hardware issue. An automatic recovery migrates the instance to another hardware during an instance reboot while retaining its instance ID, private IP, Elastic IP, and its instance metadata, which was, you know, that could definitely cause you some issues if you lost your Elastic IP for public access to your server. So that's part of the reason why you had that option to not recover. If you still want the old behavior because you're a sadist, that is available to you as a configuration. You can now turn off automatic recovery. So your server just sits there dead waiting for you to come help it out.
Would you keep your... I can't remember if the instance ID would stay the same if an instance was unhealthy.
I don't recall the instance ID staying or changing, but I do know the IP, the internal and the external, would definitely change.
Yeah, yeah. So the internal IP could be a main reason why they wouldn't, previously they hadn't automatically restarted it, because so many people, unfortunately, their environments aren't dynamic enough to where they need to know the IPs of those boxes, and it would break anyway. Then it'd be up and running and still broken.
Yeah,
yeah, and hard to see what had happened at that point, because right, you see the machine running there, but well, what happened to it? Why did the IP change?
Why did the IP change? Exactly. Yeah,
I still like to see live migrations if they detect
an
underlying hardware failure and it can be live migrated to another host. I really wish they'd do that.
Do you think that's technically feasible in 1997? I mean, 2022.
Yeah. No shit. Remember the first time I saw that on VMware, I was like super impressed. Migrated running machine. And if you've got a fast enough network and the machine's not actually doing a whole lot of work, then yeah, it works really well. But even if you were to suspend it, then migrate it and then bring it back up again, which is a lot more reliable than trying to do it while it's running. I mean, that just seems like a no-brainer.
No-brainer.
All right, let's talk about AWS backup. There's two announcements in the AWS backup space this week. First of all, you can now restore your virtual disk from a protected copy of your VMware virtual machines if you're running VMware virtual machines on, of course, on top of EC2. You can also now do that with VMware Cloud on AWS Outposts, which is your VMware software-defined data center on VMware Cloud on top of AWS Outposts, because you love to have layers upon layers upon layers of control panels to manage your simple systems that you have running. But if you need to back up a single drive or a backup of one of those things, you can now do that with AWS Backup, just killing your needs for all those expensive backup software solutions you've been using for decades.
Could there possibly be a more expensive way to run a VM than on VMware Cloud on AWS Outposts?
Yes, yes, there is. And I can tell you, it's run it on Oracle Exadata.
Thank you.
You're welcome. But other than that, yes, this is probably the second most expensive way to do it. Well, if you've ever been in the EZ2 console, either the new single page one we just talked about or the wizard, you'll know that trying to find an AMI can be sort of a nightmare because they're always, you know, thousands and thousands of pages. And that's because every AMI that's ever been publicly listed has been a return on your search result, but no longer. Amazon is now automatically adding a 2-year deprecation set flag on all public AMIs after the creation date. This means that public AMIs that are more than 2 years old will by default be deprecated. And once an AMI is deprecated, it'll no longer appear in Describe Images API calls or via the console. Deprecating AMI only reduces the visibility of the AMI on your untargeted searches, but continues to be usable and available to you so you don't break your automation. So, which is the right balance here, because I don't want to create new things on the old and broken, but I do want to continue to let my autoscaling group that uses the old and broken continue to autoscale as if nothing happened. And again, you know, if you're using an AMI that's more than 2 years old, it's probably way out of date and full of security holes. And this is something that I think AWS needs to do for quite a while.
Yeah,
I think that made a mistake with the way AMI numbering worked. I really think you should have been able to provision versions of AMIs, keep the same AMI ID, just as we do with container images, keep the same image name or AMI name, but then put a version number on the end of it. Because really, using that search functionality in the console, you find all kinds of old versions of things. Which great, I can deploy it, but there's a new version. But you don't tell me there's a new version. The version's in a description string or somewhere, which is really unparsable or hard to filter out with code in Terraform or something like that. So I mean, unless you've got tagged AMIs, private AMIs, it's really hard to find the latest versions of things. And yeah. I know there's like SNS topics where a lot of the managed AMIs get published updates, so you know what the current version, what the current AMI ID is. It's just not ideal.
It should be easy.
It should be easy, yeah.
But even doing it in CloudFormation or in Terraform, like there's like weird lookup functions you can do to find the latest AMI, which, you know, and I just look at that, and I'm like, wow, it'd be really nice if you just did the Docker model where I'm like, Amazon Linux 2 colon
latest, right?
Yeah. You know, latest Q1 2022, because that's, you know, they release them quarterly. I don't know why they don't just add that metadata overlay, because I think we'd all be much happier with that.
Yeah, they kind of shoehorned it into Parameter Store, I think, didn't they? There's a select publicly readable Parameter Store.
Yeah, they did. That was the weird lookup you had to do.
Yeah.
Which is when your answer to my problem is you need to go use Parameter Store. I know I'm going to have a bad day. So, but yeah, that one I feel is like there's an easy solution that Docker invented for them. They should just blamelessly copy that from them, because I think it's a great model, and you know it's very similar to how we do software versioning as well.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's copyrightable, so just copy it.
Exactly. Well, things that were copyrightable but now have new names, like Elasticsearch to OpenSearch. I've gotten a new release this week with the OpenSearch 1.2 release from Amazon. The 1.1 version shipped in January, so you know we're about 4 months later. So if they're going to stay on this pace, then we'll have maybe a couple more releases this year. Quite a few new features in the 1.2. A new observability interface allowing developers and DevOps engineers to more easily analyze trace data and log data in a single pane of glass. A piped processing language-based event explorer helps developers interactively explore log data and visualize the results in a simple-to-configure chart. And developers can save their PPL-based visualization and view multiple saved virtualizations on a custom operational panel. Also now integrated is an OpenSearch notebook, which developers can use to interactively and collaboratively develop rich reports that combine Markdown, SQL, PPL, and visualizations with support for multi-timelines and live data so that users can easily tell a story with their dashboard. There's also a new feature attribution and anomaly detection, which allows you to provide an attribution ratio for each input feature to help you understand how they contributed to an anomaly. More efficient K-NN dense vectors, which some data nerd just got really excited about that. And match query support in SQL and PPL language, which again was that piped processing language, all in OpenSearch version 1.2.
I'm sorry, it's after 5 p.m.
Yeah,
I didn't do Elasticsearch after 5 p.m.
This isn't Elasticsearch. This is OpenSearch. It's a different thing.
This is OpenSearch. Too much.
It's good to see they're adding features, and I believe these features are not ones which exist in Elasticsearch at this point now. So, kind of diverging from the other feature set. So maybe they'll start to appeal to some new customers.
Yeah, I think it's interesting the choice that Amazon sort of taking with OpenSearch, where, you know, Elastic continues to go down this, like, we're going to create this whole AI ML thing, and we're continuing to try to do better and more interesting things with enterprise search and all these things. And Amazon's like, yeah, we don't really care about those things. We have things like Kendra for that. But we're going to make a really amazing observability platform on top of this product and really start tuning it in that direction. And that seems to be the direction they're kind of going with it. They still, of course, provide you a full text search capability, but that's really the easiest use case you can do in Elastic for many people. So I think that use case is pretty well baked, but observability is where a lot of the growth potential is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it kind of makes sense. I mean, Elastic, people who are running Elasticsearch have data in Elasticsearch clusters, then wanted ML capabilities, so now they're adding it. Whereas in AWS, you weren't using OpenSearch before, and you weren't using Elasticsearch for ML because we had SageMaker and these other things, and so your data was already elsewhere. It doesn't make sense to focus on ML features for Elasticsearch when there's much better tools for the job.
Agreed. Well, moving to Google, you can reduce your scaling costs by up to 50% in Cloud Spanner with the new double provisioned storage. They're increasing the amount of storage on each node from 2 terabytes to 4 terabytes per node. Customers previously would have to overscale their compute to achieve the storage needs and incur additional costs. Current Spanner customers are automatically upgraded to the new increased storage capacity without the need to opt in or create new instances. This feature does not change storage pricing or the way it is built, and users will still pay for the actual storage their database uses, regardless of the storage capacity Spanner has provisioned. And they give us an example here saying, if you have 50 nodes and 100 terabytes of storage in your single region Spanner instance with 40% high CPU utilization, with this new limit, you could, in theory, reduce it to 25 nodes. However, this would be over the 65% recommended Spanner threshold. But you could reduce it to 31 nodes, and now your CPU is at 65%, and you're saving 19 nodes worth of cost. And I love how they undermine their own selves by going from 50 to 25, but nope, can't do that. And they even called it out in the article, which is sort of hilarious to me. I'm like, that's just a wrinkle you didn't really need to cover. You kind of ruined your own story there. But still, 19 node savings in a Spanner cluster of that size could be a significant savings, you know, based on the compute cost.
Yeah, and probably a performance increase as well, because if you don't have to worry about consensus between all those nodes, you start getting responses faster.
Yeah. You also have bigger failure domains too, though, because now 4 terabytes of data is on a Spanner node and it dies, and now it has to recover that quorum somewhere else. That's a lot more overhead too. So there's pluses and minuses to everything, Jonathan, as you know. Mm-hmm. Well, if you are excited about big data things, which I know our podcast listeners and hosts definitely are, Google has several new capabilities this week to help you deal with the limitless data across all workloads and extend that data to everyone. And the first is the Big Lake. Big Lake is a data lake storage engine to remove data limits by unifying data lakes and warehouses. Managing data across disparate lakes and warehouses creates silos and increase risk and cost, especially when data needs to be moved. The Big Lake allows companies to unify their data warehouse and lakes to analyze data without worrying about the underlying storage format or system, which limits the need to duplicate or move data from source and reduces costs and inefficiencies. Big Lake also gives you a fine-grained access control with an API interface spanning Google Cloud and open file formats like Parquet, along with open source processing engines like Apache Spark. So I'll stop there before I go to the next one.
Are they saving Big Ocean? Are they saving it for like the next layer of unification above, like when we need to aggregate multiple big lakes?
I mean, potentially you'll have to.
It's at some point there's got to be a term that just means all of it.
Yeah, I mean, I am sort of enjoying this like world we live in now, where I can have a data puddle, I can have a data stream, I can have a data lake, I can have a data mud pit. You know, there's all kinds of ways you can use this analogy that are just fantastic. I can have a data ocean someday. I mean, I can't wait for that. You know, maybe the next iteration of Spanner will be data ocean. So the global data lake. See it now. Opportunities.
Yeah.
The next announcement in this was the Spanner Change Streams. This is the new product coming soon, which will further remove data limits for customers, allowing them to track changes within their Spanner database in real time in order to unlock new value. Spanner Change Streams track inserts, updates, and deletes to stream the changes in real time across a customer's entire Spanner database. And this ensures customers have access to the freshest data, as they can easily replicate changes from Spanner to BigQuery for real-time analytics, trigger downstream application behaviors using PubSub, or store changes in Google Cloud Storage for compliance.
That's a neat feature. I use a similar DynamoDB Streams feature to track changes in those tables. So this is really great. I mean, you kind of think that if you're putting data in yourself or updating data yourself, then you could already have been doing this by like dual publishing to a queue or something somewhere, but having the service do it for you without having to change your app if you want to add on functionality that monitors for those changes serverlessly even. That's really cool.
Yeah, even if it's just different development groups within your own organization and you're all they're building and you just want to pull off that and know what's going on. It's great.
Yeah, definitely. And then the Vertex AI Workbench is now generally available with native integrations like BigQuery, Serverless, Spark, and Dataproc, as well as the connected sheets for Looker, which allows you to access Looker data models within your Data Studio. So this is all coming out of the Google Data Summit that I mentioned many, many times in the end of the show where I talk about what's coming up. And so this is all announced at the Data Summit for Google. If you attended that virtually, you would have already known about all these great announcements. So do pay attention to what we're talking about in the what's coming up, because you can get this information real time right from the source and then go ask questions to people who know more than us about some of these technologies. So it's pretty great.
Hey everyone, Jonathan here. I just wanted to take a minute to thank the cloud consulting gurus at Foghorn for helping make the Cloud Pod possible. These folks truly get it. Cloud consulting experts since 2008, they are premier tier partners with AWS, Google Cloud Platform Silver, and Microsoft Azure partners. From multi-cloud to containers to moving full production workloads to the cloud under the tightest compliance, Foghorn's team of full-stack cloud engineers have been there, done that, gotten the t-shirt, and are ready to share their experience with you. If you're in the market for some talent to supplement your team, visit www.fogops.io/thecloudpod. www.fogops.io/thecloudpod. Foghorn, the promise of cloud delivered.
All right, let's move on to Azure, who has two new instance types for us this week. Two, and they both are named terribly.
Yeah.
First is the announcement of the general availability of the EBS V5 VM series, which is a new addition to the EV5 Azure VM family, which offers up to 120,000 IOPS and 4,000 megabits of remote disk storage throughput. They also include up to 500 gigs of RAM and a local SSD up to 2,400 gigabytes. This new VM series provides up to 3 times the remote storage performance compared to previous VM generations and helps consolidate existing workloads on fewer VMs or smaller VMs to achieve potential cost savings. And those cost savings would cost you for the 2 vCPU and 16 gig memory box, $189 a month, or the 64 vCPU 512 box would cost you $6,060.24 a month.
It's a lot of IOPS.
It is. Only SQL Server could consume something like that.
Yeah.
And then apparently Azure is getting into the ARM-based business with the new ARM-based Neoverse N1 CPU, the Ampere Ultra ARM-based processor. I did notice the ARM Neoverse N1 is also marketed as the thing powering AWS Graviton 2. So you will not see any benchmarks from Azure comparing theirs to Graviton 2, since apparently it's the same thing. So that's keep that in mind here. But they do say there's up to a 50% improvement on comparable x86 VMs for scale-out workloads. And these have amazingly fantastic names like DPS V5 and EPS 5 VMs running the latest Ampere Ultra or Ultra ARM-based processors with 2 to 64 vCPUs and 8 to 208 gigs of memory. And it supports all the storage except for, sadly, the Ultra Disk storage is not available yet. But they did say it is coming soon to the Ampere set as well. We did link to a lovely chart which showed the performance comparisons from Ampere, the people who made this chip. And they show that their box is crushing all the other boxes, including an Intel Xeon 8380 and the AMD EPYC 7763. There you go.
Assuming everybody compiles their stuff for ARM, you see any, I guess this question would be for Jonathan the most, you see any reason that chip manufacturers are going to continue innovating on x86?
Any reason? I don't know.
I mean, Intel would like them to.
Yeah. It's a tough sell, isn't it? Why would you continue to do that? Cross compilers have been around forever. It supports everything that Intel does. I still think there are still some performance misses in those Neoverse cores. I think the 64-bit multiply is not as performant as it is on Xeon. So if you have like really heavily intensive crypto workloads for like TLS 1.2, 1.3, they're not necessarily as performant as on a Xeon. But there are other things you can do to mitigate that. So you can use different crypto algorithms. I don't know. I mean, I think it's a no-brainer to switch to ARM. I've been a huge fan of it for such a long time. Less power, less money.
And now it's just basically money at this point when you're not worrying about running your own data center.
Yeah.
I don't know. For me, it is.
Indeed. I think there'll always be individual optimizations which manufacturers have made. And even between the Graviton 2 and the Azure version of the same custom hardware, I mean, it's the same Neoverse core, but they're still supporting silicon around that, which adds the custom bits that Amazon wanted and the custom bits that Azure wanted. So it's not going to be quite as simple as that, but yeah, I think Intel are going to struggle.
The custom stuff that Amazon has and the custom stuff that Azure has is not the stuff that's going to move a benchmark realistically. I mean, maybe right. In some small ways, like, you know, if you're moving network throughput off the die into another subset of processing, you know, maybe get something there. You know, you can offload in this Neoverse 1.1 to a crypto-based core, which kind of just focus on crypto work. But like you said, it's just one of the processors doing crypto, not all of them. So there are some weaknesses in this architecture, but I do suspect that, you know, the N2 will probably be coming out at some point from Neoverse. There'll be other ones coming which will power, you know, future Graviton systems as well. You know, they're not out yet, but I'm sure they'll be coming anytime soon. That's how these things work.
Yeah, and I think there's still opportunity for the tooling to catch up. Obviously, compilers have to take advantage of the features that the CPUs offer, and Intel's been around forever, and they all optimize really beautifully for Xeons, and not so much for ARM just yet, but we're getting there.
Yep. And the more people compile, the more people use this, the more optimizations get made to the software stacks that run these things on ARM, and you know, we have decades of performance tuning x86. We don't have as much time with ARM yet. All right. Well, if you are someone who has a large number of IP addresses that you would like to repurpose to Azure, you can now do so with the Bring Your Own IP capability with the custom IP prefix. The ability to bring your own public IPv4 range to Azure and use them like any other Azure-owned public IP. Once onboarded, these IPs can be associated with Azure resources, interacted with private IPs and VNets within Azure's network, and reach external destinations by egressing from the Microsoft WAN. It's available in all regions. You can transfer in a minimum size of a /24 and can be used across multiple subscriptions.
Well, that's fancy.
About time is my thought.
Yeah. It is good to be able to do it. And I still pity the poor companies who need to migrate IP address, anchor their IPs to a provider in order to get their DR functionality. So this now makes that possible, however bad a pattern that is in the cloud.
I can think of a couple of reasons to want to do it. I mean, one would be, if you really care about your IP reputation and you don't want to use a cloud IP, which could float between customers, some of which send spam and some of which don't send spam, or some of which get malware installed and get blacklisted, and all of a sudden you inherit that same public IP the next day and you can't send mail, or you can't make a connection to a particular service someplace because Bitdefender or one of those other services has put you on a blacklist. So I mean, I guess IP reputation is one thing. Then I guess you've got the customers who still use IP whitelisting for connectivity, which is still a terrible idea, but it's still not going away.
Not going away. FTP is still here.
God, really? Yeah, it is. I think it's a shame. It's a shame you can't move less than a /24, but that's just a limitation of the way blocks are assigned. Otherwise, I mean, I don't know many customers this will really impact, apart from customers who have an enormous amount of IP space and can afford to put /24s in each region. I think it's going to be a win for the cloud providers too, because I mean, I know Amazon's been snapping up as much IP space as they can, and it's running out, or it has run out. So if they can encourage customers to bring their own and sell them on the use cases that it's better to bring your own IPs than use ours, then they won't run out quite as quickly.
Yeah. And I'm sure this is a blocker for a ton of companies with all the needs you just described from migrating to the cloud. So here you go.
Yeah.
Do we ever really feel IPv6 is going to become mainstream? I feel like my entire IT career, now 20 some odd years of it, has been IPv6 is the future and going to be the big thing any day. And yet IPv4 just continues to live and be dominant. And I sort of just kind of got numb to those people who tell me IPv6 is going to be the future, but I feel like it has to be, right? At some point. I just don't know when that day is.
And it seems like we got so close with like people moving to the cloud really forced people to rely less on what their IP address is. And if you don't care what your IP address is, then I think moving from IPv4 to IPv6 is a lot simpler than if you care. So hopefully we're getting there.
Well, that's probably true, right? Because I think you know, the smallest size you typically could buy when you had a IPv4 block was what, a /28, I think, was where you could, it was the smallest that you could buy from at the time. So, I mean, if you only needed one IP address, you still had another 5 you weren't using. So there was a lot of waste in a lot of the models of IP addresses when you were leasing them in the past. So maybe that is part of it. It's just that as we freed up capacity and we don't care about IP, then yeah, if I don't care, I can use a lot more smaller subnets.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the move from, you know, class A, B, and C networks, which wasted at least 2 or 3 addresses per subnet. I mean, yeah, that was pretty bad. CIDR really helped. But I mean, I don't think you can say that the IPv6 adoption isn't happening. I mean, every mobile device on 5G, you turn off Wi-Fi and hit like whatsmyipaddress.com or whatever that site is, and you're going to be getting an IPv6 address back. So there's an awful lot of mobile devices. Mm-hmm.
That's true. Like a mobile website, you need to be IPv6 enabled to be able to be seen on a mobile device. Like I know like the CloudPod website, for example, is hosted on IPv6 for that exact reason as well, because we have to have it. Otherwise, you know, you can't browse on mobile. But it still feels, I mean, maybe it is more mainstream than I'm thinking it is, but it just feels like internal network-wise, we're still very heavily IPv4 based maybe. But publicly, you're right. Maybe public's where we see it happen first.
You know what would have forced that? You know what would have forced this like 20 years ago would be if private IP address non-routable numbers didn't exist.
Yes, it would have forced it a much, much longer time ago. And if you didn't invent NAT, you also would have needed to solve this a lot longer ago.
Yeah, because everyone needs their own IP address. We'd be on IPv12 by now. Yeah.
All right. Well, you can now reserve capacity for AKS and get Azure Dedicated Host support for AKS this week. You can reserve capacity in 1 to 3 year increment terms, and you can create and delete the reservations at any time and have full control over how you want to manage those reservations. And then for the Dedicated Host is a service that provides physical servers to host one or more virtual machines dedicated to one Azure subscription. Dedicated Host are the same physical servers used in the data centers provided as a resource to you, meaning you can now get bare metal AKS in Azure Cloud.
Not sure what to make of that. I mean, without a commitment, how do they offer a reservation without a commitment? Presumably, you have to spin it up and then say, "I want to keep this for me," and they keep it for you for the foreseeable future. I mean, how is
so? They're basically so. This is how you build a spot market. So what you do is you allow companies to reserve capacity at a discount, you know, which basically is not the same cost as the reserved instance. And then you take that capacity and you reserve it for those clients, and then you sell the capacity that's not actually being used to everyone on the spot market. And then when they actually need the capacity, you kick all those people out of the spot market.
Perfect. Yeah. And you can, even if you don't have a spot market, you can charge less because you can literally not be running the boxes, right? They could be powered down. And so you're, variable cost is lower to run those.
Maybe. I think that's a risk for them, though, because, again, you know, an API-driven provisioning process, I now need to spin up 100 boxes on an API call for my choose my capacity reservation. That may, you know, they're not able to meet their SLA for that, but maybe they have...
I don't know. I mean, we did it with made drives. I don't see why they can't do it with
perhaps
boxes.
I suppose they could still maintain a pool of free resources, but it would just have to be a smaller pool. So in the case of spinning up 100 machines, you wouldn't have to wait for 100 spot machines to spin down before you could do that. You'd have a pool of 100 sitting there waiting to be used, and then you could assign those requests to those spare ones, and then the spot instances go away over the next couple of minutes, and they become the next free ones in the pool potentially. So it wouldn't be that slow. I mean, that's if you're smart enough to automate it that way, I guess.
I mean, this is Azure we're talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
You think one of two things is happening. The designers of the solution are like listening to the podcast saying, oh my God, listened how they think we're doing it. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Or they're like, hey guys, Cloudbot had a great idea.
I hope it's the first
one. We should create a spot market.
Yeah, I have no inside information that's how they actually do their spot market. But it just makes sense that you would take this capacity, you reserve it for a company, then you resell it to somebody else, and you make twice as much money as you would have if you sold it to one customer. It seems like a brilliant plan to me. And it works out perfectly because these compliance frameworks require dumb things like capacity reservations, so you have to support the need.
Yeah.
Well, America's pastime is back this week, guys, and that is with baseball, which had its opening night, I think, on Thursday. And then, the Giants, which is our San Francisco team, is local to us. Their opening night is on the 8th. And, the key thing is that San Francisco Giants need to choose the best cloud to support strategic objectives for their need, particularly a need to DR their critical data files and video. And you know who they chose for that purpose?
I would have to guess based on the huge sponsor on the outside of their building.
Yes, that would be right, Peter. It would be Oracle. They chose Oracle Cloud and replaced AWS for their DR of their critical data files and video to the Oracle Cloud from AWS. The team apparently has over 200 terabytes of video that it uses for scouting and player development, but also for in-stadium programming. And the video is now stored on OCI for backup and DR, but the CIO there expects the team to increase the amount and scope of cloud computing it uses over time. And as Peter mentioned, they did just take over the naming of the baseball stadium. And they also just replaced the point-of-sale system they only implemented 3 years ago with Oracle solution, which could only be sort of related to the naming branding relationship, I'm sure. I mean, there's no possibility that could be any other story. But Bill Schlau is their chief information officer for the San Francisco Giants, and he had a couple quotes in this article. Higher quality video is driving the need for more storage. Then the question is, where do you keep it? You probably want to have something that's real-time accessible. And while much of the video processing in LX has traditionally been done on site, people are increasingly working from remote locations, and you want your video editors and producers to be working with that video, so you need it in the cloud. He goes on to say later in this article, it's no longer about just moving the cloud to the cloud and Oracle's in the cloud. Oracle has to be the best provider in the cloud because the cloud's going forward. Bringing the cloud is table stakes across all aspects of our operations, and we need to have the flexibility to be able to spin up servers as needed and spin up compute capacity. So whether it's making better decisions with respect to artificial intelligence or analytics or other technology, or whether we have the right food at the right price in the ballpark, we have to be in the cloud to be able to do that.
None of which they're doing, because it's all about DR for files. So they're not using a lot of compute. They're not using those features.
Well, I mean, he's saying they're going to do more. Yeah. But right now, the thing they went live with is DR, which is a very minor thing.
Where are their original copies of the file? Are they still in AWS or are they on-prem?
I'm gonna guess they're on AWS.
Yeah, I'm thinking so. So when you said they were picking the best cloud for their strategic objectives, I didn't realize that they were going into the legal system and suing their players.
I mean, I'm just really impressed that their DR can fit inside of a garage in a single rack. I mean, that's the part I'm most impressed about. Well, that was a fun little side story too. Welcome baseball back to the world on top of apparently Oracle Cloud. But of course, the rest of Major League Baseball is on Google nowadays because Google paid for them to move off of AWS as well. Major League Baseball, opportunists at all times.
Well, it must have been working because today, the day we recorded, the Giants won their home opener.
Sweet.
Yeah.
I was trying not to mention what day we're recording since this is technically the Wednesday episode. But that's okay, Peter. You just... curtain.
We edited that back in afterwards, right?
Come on.
It's all good. It's all good.
Everyone knows we don't stick to any sort of schedule whatsoever.
Hey, we've been publishing pretty consistently on Wednesday, except for last week when I forgot. But other than that... All right, Peter. Well, let's take us to the lightning round.
All right, now in public preview, Azure Bastion support for Kerberos authentication.
And this is why we don't give nice things to Microsoft, because they ruin it with things like Kerberos.
And how about Amazon FSx for NetApp on Tap now enables you to change the throughput capacity of your file systems.
Which is code for, we need to make more money on NetApp on Tap, so we're going to charge you way more throughput.
Ooh. Yeah, I mean, like, I just want the right amount of throughput. Don't change it on me. AWS Lambda console now supports bulk update of layers.
Lambda, I'm going to bulk you up.
Sustainability pillar is now available in the AWS Well Architected tool, which is now the sixth, I believe, pillar of Well Architected.
As a partner, you would definitely know how many pillars there are, more so than I do.
There's a lot of pillars. It's becoming...
And lenses and micro lenses. It's getting complicated.
It's getting complicated.
I would say that perspectives, I'd say that Well Architected needs to be Well Architected. That's my opinion.
Well, Architected has got a lot better in the last year or so, last couple of years, I think.
I mean, the organization of the Well Architected has not gotten better in the last few years. The Well Architected tools themselves, like what they're actually checking, has gotten better. But I like the tool.
It's so much better than the spreadsheet we used to have to use.
Oh yeah, the spreadsheet was awful.
Yeah.
So I assume this is sustainability in terms of cutting down trees and
carbon emissions. Fuels.
This is not sustainability of the poor people working on the products.
all the ops team who have to
run them.
No. This is all about your CO2 offset.
Amazon ECS announces increased service quotas for container instances per cluster.
When they announced the last increase to 2,000 containers per cluster to now 5,000 containers per cluster, I do want to remind you to think about your blast radius and how badly you want to have an outage and how big you want that outage to be when it occurs. And think smart.
Yeah, this was the same complaint that we had against GKE, wasn't it? When they extended it to 10,000 instances.
Yep.
Like, why?
Sure did.
Why would you do that?
Because you like to have really massive outages. That's why.
Yeah.
It was on SageMaker Data Wrangler now supports Databricks as a data source.
All I can envision is a cowboy with a lasso trying to wrangle him some Databricks, and then that Databrick is going to hit him in the head because it's a brick. So just be careful with this tool.
Yeah. Well, let's wrap it up by announcing the general availability of Amazon Athena ACID transactions, because everything has to be ACID, powered by Apache Iceberg, known as the fastest form of water.
I don't know how a Athena system is now ACID compliant, considering how long it takes to do anything, but okay. I'm more intrigued by how there's icebergs involved in ACID, and like there's a parallel to the Titanic here somewhere. I'm not sure where it is, though.
I heard they talked to a working group about this before they released it, but it went down like the Titanic.
No!
Indeed it did.
Oh, it's so difficult. I got Hans and Franz. I got the Titanic. I'm going Titanic.
Nice.
Sorry, Justin. They were both fine. Spectacular.
That's good.
Yeah.
We got to keep it a contest so it's not over by the time we get to June.
It is actually a pretty close competition this year. Like we're keeping it, my co-hosts have learned the errors of their ways. They're improving. It's getting more difficult for me, which I appreciate because I don't want to win every year.
Well, you do, but just not, not so.
Yes.
Obviously.
Not in June. You don't want to win in June.
Yeah. I mean, like, what's the mercy rule? Like, when you're up so far that it's just, it's no longer fun.
Yes.
Mercy in this game. Yeah. Well, there are things coming up in the cloud once again. I mentioned to you guys earlier the Google Cloud Data Summit, where you could have learned about all of the exciting things I talked about earlier with the big data or the big lake and the other things that I forgot already. But they have another one of these coming up for Google Workspaces. For those of you who are like, what's Google Workspaces? This is what they call Gmail for enterprise and all your Google Docs and your Google Sheets and all those great things. So if you're excited for the new innovations that may be delivering to you at a Google Workspaces, that is coming up very quickly on May 4th. So do sign up for that right away. And then we are just a few weeks away from the AWS Summit in San Francisco. Which I have still not, they're trying to tempt me to come. I keep saying no. So I'm not there. I'm not going. You can't make me. Maybe you will. I don't know. We'll see.
If you do, I think Alex might be there.
Sweet. Yeah. It's good to see Alex, CEO of Foghorn. Thank him for his sponsorship. and letting us borrow Peter once a week and harass him.
Yeah.
Which is really the bigger part.
It's like day release, right?
Yes. Yeah, really.
I do think IBM Think is coming up, I think, May 9th through the 13th. And then KubeCon Europe is coming up May 16th through 20th, where you'll learn all the exciting things coming to Kubernetes later in the year. And then the DevOps Enterprise Summit Virtual Europe is May 10th through the 12th. So another fantastic set of events coming up. Get those signed up for now. Most of them are virtual. I did also see WWDC, which we don't typically cover here, is going virtual once again this year. So, you know, there's companies that are like, nope, we're going in person. And then there's companies that are like, nope, we're staying at home. And the Reinforce Conference, which still moved to Boston, is right around the same time as WWDC. So Amazon, we're going in person. Apple, no, we're not. But we're making our employees go to the office. But, you know, can't have all your wins, I guess. So there you go. That's it for this week in the cloud.
See you later.
And that is the week in cloud. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Foghorn Consulting. Subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and tweet us your feedback at #TheCloudPod. Or join our Slack channel, go to our website, thecloudpod.net, for sign-up instructions.